The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So often I think in coming to a meditation practice, we might orient or be interested in special experiences or different experiences, at least from our usual ordinary experience, states of at least being interested in finding our way to states of calm or concentration or ease or peace. And this is a helpful thing to do. It is definitely supportive of our practice to explore and cultivate that kind of capacity to settle the mind, collect the mind, so that it has a space of ease, of peace, from which to then explore other areas of experience. But today I'd really like to orient to a different perspective. I'd like to talk about how we can actually use ordinariness as a path. I think that much of our practice unfolds not only with ordinary capacities of mind, but with very ordinary experience. And so this is the the emphasis that I'd like to talk about today. And excuse my voice, I have a little bit of a cold. Partly the cold was the reason I decided to talk about this topic. That's a pretty ordinary experience, having a cold, and yet there's a lot that we can learn from being willing to meet that too. It doesn't have to be separate from our meditation practice. I mean, you might think, oh, I'm sick, I've got a cold, I can't breathe, why bother meditating? But I find it actually is a really great practice. So that's part of the inspiration for why I decided to pick this topic this morning. So the first thing I want to point out is that mindfulness itself, I mean, we often orient towards mindfulness here at the center. Mindfulness practice is a key meditation practice we offer, that we explore here. And mindfulness itself is an ordinary quality of mind. It's not something special or only available if you start meditating. It actually happens. It's happened since we were born, this capacity. Well, maybe not since we were born. I don't know when the point comes where we can know that we know. It may be not quite as we're, you know, when we're first born, but there's some point in our lives that we develop to the point, and it's when we're young children, maybe 3 or 4, that we can know that we know. We can be aware that we are aware. And this is this capacity to know what's happening in the present moment, to be aware of what's happening in the present moment. It's just a very ordinary capacity of our minds. And it actually happens to us a lot in our day, in our lives. In some ways, I think we couldn't function in our normal lives without this capacity for mindfulness. We need to know that we know at times in order to further what we're doing. If you're walking across the street completely lost in your thoughts and not aware of what's happening in the present moment, you may get hit by a car. You know, so just the simplicity of knowing what's happening in the present moment is a function that serves us in very ordinary ways. And it happens a lot. You know, it, in a moment, you know, you're walking across the street lost in thought and you hear a car horn and boom, you're there. You're right, you're back, right? You're the thoughts vanish and you're right back present. And yet in that moment, what we do with that is, you know, we look at what's happening and we move forward and we get out of the way of the car or whatever. And so we, you know, we don't actually recognize in that moment that we have become aware. We simply act on what we become aware of. And this is a very useful, I mean, obviously this is very useful function for mindfulness. And the Buddha actually recognized this ordinary function of mind, this very ordinary capacity of mind, as having another purpose. And this is what's a little unordinary about the mindfulness of what we do here. I mean, the typical way that we use this capacity of mindfulness before we meet meditation would be to, you know, further our day, further our agendas, further our views. You know, a lot of it oriented towards the future, some of it towards navigating what happened in the past and changing things. And so the way that we use mindfulness typically is, you know, often oriented around me and what I need to do and what I need to get and how I need to go someplace. So that orientation is one that the Buddha tweaked a little bit. He said this capacity for mindfulness is really powerful when it's used in a particular way. And in particular, he said, it's helpful if we turn that capacity for mindfulness to being aware of actually what's going on in the present moment, to learn from what's going on in the present moment, to wake up to it, not to further an agenda, but rather have the purpose of mindfulness be turning to learn, what is this present moment experience? How does this present moment experience, is this present moment experience an experience of ease or peace, or is it an experience of stress or suffering? And to begin to look at that, to begin to recognize that. And so in our mindfulness practice, we're asked to use this mindfulness in a different way, to turn to learn about this moment, this present moment. I mean, this present moment is really all that we have. This is also very ordinary, you know, that this is where we live in the present moment. And yet we forget it regularly. We forget regularly that this is the only place that we live. And we're so willing to project into the future with our thoughts and think about what we're going to be doing, completely losing track of what's here and now. Or we're willing to be lost in the past, arguing with friends over and over again, when, you know, what's really happening is right now. We're losing the present moment. So much of the way we live our lives, we actually miss our lives because we're lost in thoughts and fantasies and regrets and plans. And so this mindfulness begins to, the mindfulness is where we are in the present moment. And then to use that, not to simply further, well, what do I want to do, but rather to look at what is this experience of me? What is this experience of a human being in this present moment with whatever it is? What is this experience of a human being in reactivity? What is this experience of a human being feeling happy? And so this is the turning. So this very ordinary quality of mind, of mindfulness, The Buddha's understanding in his path as he came to see the possibility for freedom was that this quality of mindfulness, this capacity of mindfulness, can be used to turn us in the direction to free us from the ways that we struggle, that we suffer in our human experience. Not that it gets rid of all unpleasant experience, not that it gets rid of what other people do, but that the orientation around freedom in the Buddha's teaching is that we begin to recognize that so much of our own inner struggle, our own suffering, our own stress comes from the fact that we are fighting with things as they already are. You know, we have experiences of unpleasantness, and we fall down and we hurt ourselves, or we have a cold, some unpleasant experience. And, if I had this morning gotten up and, actually I did have this thought right before I opened my eyes to give this, I can't do this. It's like, well, you're going to do this. Yes, I'm going to do this. It's like, don't fight this. It's happening, It's like that, I can't do this, is a contraction. Already there's a contraction. And, that creates stress, that creates suffering. If I can just open to, oh, this is what's happening. That doesn't mean that the unpleasantness of the cold goes away, but the resistance and the reactivity is a huge part of why we suffer. That is the definition of suffering in the First Noble Truth, that way that we are kind of fighting with the way things are, the way things already are, actually. And this doesn't mean that So not fighting with the way things already are. Already here, I've got this cold. it doesn't mean that I don't take action to, have my warm water with me or, have my cough drops or something. It doesn't mean I don't take action to make the next moments more workable. And likewise, in a larger situation, let's talk about a larger situation, such as injustice in the world. This is so huge. It's so painful, the amount of injustice in the world. And, when we meet that, when we meet injustice in the world, when we see how injustice in a large scale, the wealthier countries using so much carbon that it's creating a situation of global warming for the planet, or the injustice of how the racist and oppressive culture from the time that this country was born has fed forward to creating a culture of oppression and racism now. We see those things and we know that some inner part of us says this isn't right. Right? Some part of us says this is not right. And so what does it mean to align with, well, yes, it's not right, but it's already like this. So to not say, I fight this in terms of contracting and aversion and, kind of closing in and being harsh and reactive in my speech and in the way that I deal with the world. What might it mean to acknowledge that and say, yes, it is already like this. I understand it is already like this. And can the heart be open enough that it's not contracted in fighting with that? When it's not contracted in fighting with that, it has the possibility to step forward into the next moment, maybe in a different way. Maybe in a way that shifts and alters the patterns in our world. So, when I say what it means to turn this ordinary quality of mindfulness to things as they already are and open to that, allow that, it doesn't mean that I'm saying you allow it to continue in the next moment or that you simply say, oh yes, things as they are, I'm witnessing some horrible thing, I just sit there and watch. Part of what we're asked to do in this process of the open heart is to recognize there is suffering happening. What does it mean to respond to that suffering with an open heart? to take action with an open heart. So this capacity of mindfulness to turn towards what's already happening, this is not an easy process. You know, to actually wake up to this is what's happening, not only in my own system, you know, what's happening here and now with me, my, you know, my cold, my little, you know, frustrations with dealing with people, or my joys and my delights, you know, what's happening here, but also as we meet the world, you know, what does it mean to wake up to that? So this is, you know, this is the ordinariness of our experience. You know, not only is mindfulness an ordinary quality, but what we're waking up to is just the ordinariness of life, the ordinariness of a cold, the ordinariness of you know, it's a horrible thing to say, but the ordinariness of racism in a way. You know, it's like, it's so pervasive. And so what does it mean to wake up to that? We start to see perhaps that, you know, the places and ways in which we're, you know, our own minds are fighting with, our own minds are colluding with patterns and processes that are kind of tumbling forward. And so this practice of mindfulness is asking us to explore, to turn towards what's happening in this moment and to learn from it. And what do we learn from it? You know, what do we learn? Just let's move it back to simplicity here. You know, what do we learn from, you know, just a simple example of when we have an unpleasant experience, you know, such as a cold or we, you know, cut ourselves with a knife. What do we learn when we notice that and we notice how we react to it? You know, what do we learn? If we're interested in learning rather than fighting with or holding on to something, what do we learn? You know, what happens when we turn towards that? You know, you see the unpleasantness of the experience. And one of the things that mindfulness really begins to help us distinguish is when something is unpleasant. You know, just the kind of objective unpleasantness of a pain as you've cut your finger, or of the running of the, you know, the soreness of a throat or something like that. Just the simple unpleasant quality there. That there's that. And then as we open with this simple, ordinary mindfulness to the actual experience, we also see often that there's reactivity to that. We don't like it. We want it to go away. We're irritated about it, or we're outright annoyed and angry about it. I remember at one point I was cutting an apple in my kitchen and it sliced through my little finger. You know, got a pretty bad cut. I had to go to the emergency room and had 3 stitches on my little finger. You know, it's like, you know, that moment. Actually, I was doing a home retreat at that point. And it was quite remarkable. It's like, oh, wow, look at that. Okay, what do I do now? You know, so there wasn't a lot of reactivity. And I was fairly easy for me to navigate, you know, going to a neighbor, asking her to drive me to the emergency room. It was fairly easy. I wasn't very reactive. And so there's that. There's the pain. I mean, it was clearly this was painful. And yet to not have the mind going, oh, I can't have this happen. You know, what do I, you know, it's kind of have the spinning of the mind. The Buddha talks about the way we react to pleasant and unpleasant as being extra. You know, that often when there's an unpleasant experience, we react to it with anger, aversion, irritation, frustration. And the analogy that is given is like, it's like we've had, you know, like we've been pierced with an arrow is the first pain. The cut of the knife, the first pain. And then it's as if we pick up another arrow and stab ourselves with it when we get angry and frustrated. And not only do we cause ourselves, you know, an extra knife or an extra jab, it's like they multiply. You know, the pain, it's not just simply adding another arrow, it's like it mushrooms, it explodes the the experience, that mental reactivity seems to exacerbate the physical pain, which then exacerbates more mental reactivity, and it's like this tumbling spiral. And so we start to see, when we turn this ordinary quality of mindfulness to something ordinary like a pain, that there's this reactivity. And if we're willing to notice, if we're willing to be present for it, we see, first of all, that that reactivity itself, when there's an unpleasant experience, that reactivity itself is unpleasant. And we also see that it's extra. We see that it's not serving us. That's a little bit harder to take in, because so much of our lives, so much of our culture has fed that we need to use these reactive emotions to further our lives. We need to be angry in order to get things done, or, you know, we need to want things in order to live our lives. And so it's a little bit harder to see that these states don't actually serve us that well. We might think, for instance, we're so used to being motivated by these reactive states. You know, this is very ordinary stuff. The way that we live our lives, the way that we usually live our lives. You know, that we think that if we're not reactive, nothing would happen. You know, we think that if I'm not angry about injustice, then change would never happen. We think that if I'm not wanting to get something, that I would never do anything. If I didn't ever have that craving for something, why would I ever do anything? So that's the way, and that's very much the way our culture has trained us in some ways. And so it takes a little bit of learning, you know, a little bit of willingness to actually explore these reactive states and first of all start to see, wow, they're painful. You know, in and of themselves, they're painful. That was one of my first insights, actually, one of my very early insights in this mindfulness practice. I was exploring my anger at a particular person, and at one point I began to realize through this process of saying, okay, I'm going to be aware when I'm angry. I'm just going to notice what it's like to be angry. And it didn't take very long before I noticed, wow, it hurts to be angry. And that was like, well, duh, you know, how could I not have noticed that? But I think I did notice it in some way, but I was so focused. I mean, my whole orientation, what I also began to see as I paid attention to that anger, is that there was a belief under there that that anger was going to make the other person miserable. And that was worth whatever I was feeling. And I wasn't particularly aware of the miserableness I was feeling until I turned the mindfulness to the experience. It was really quite a revelation, because many of you know this story. I was in the Peace Corps at the time. I was 7,000 miles away on a country in the South Pacific, and the person I was angry with was in California. And this mind state of anger, you know, is like, yeah, it's making me miserable. It's not doing a thing to that person. And it was a real aha moment. It's like, wow, this hurts this being, this state of reactivity is painful here and now. And so the mind began to learn, with mindfulness, the mind began to learn, this is not helpful. The mind began to learn, this is not the direction towards well-being. And it began to reorient. The mind began to let go of that pattern. Slowly, slowly, over the next few years, the mind began to let go of that pattern of reactivity towards that person. And what we begin to see, too, as we turn towards these ordinary experiences, you know, these ordinary experiences teach us extraordinary things. I mean, just that simple moment of recognizing, wow, anger hurts. You know, it's a little aha moment. And we start to recognize, too, that as we let go of that, it doesn't mean that we just sit like a blob and don't do anything. But there's other forces at work in our hearts that motivate us. Forces like compassion and generosity and love and wisdom that can motivate action, that can inspire us to make changes in the world, that can inspire us to be a better person. So turning towards our ordinary experience can start to show us this. You know, in some ways there's this, when we explore this simple, ordinary quality of mindfulness and begin to have the sense of its value, you know, it actually doesn't take that long to get a sense of the value of mindfulness. Even in little spurts, you know, and even in little spurts, we begin to recognize how helpful it is. Just being able to wake up into something and not blurt something out, or be able to shift our direction as we see our mind, as we see something, you know, our mind constricted and wanting to take some action that's not so helpful. In moments, we can wake up and see, oh, that's not so helpful. And so as the power of mindfulness gets stronger, as we begin to understand the value of mindfulness, we begin to be more interested in cultivating it, and then it strengthens. We begin to have more access to this power of mindfulness and the interest of turning it to just ordinary experience, to learn from ordinary experience. We start to see that this capacity, or it feels like to me that mindfulness becomes a power as it strengthens. And in some ways it feels like it's got this magical property, this power of mindfulness. It creates the container, it creates the landscape, let's say, in which we're learning about our experience. And as we just explored a little bit around reactive emotions, we begin to see with reactive emotions, when we turn and say, well, what is the experience of being a human being having this reactive emotion? We see, wow, that doesn't feel good. You know, it hurts. And so the willingness to turn and be mindful of that, it's like the mind is getting a new education. The mind is learning that this state of mind, this experience, doesn't lead towards well-being in the moment. And before, I mean, as I said before, you know, my mind in that example, you know, my mind had been kind of leaping forward to, well, you know, somehow believing that I would be happier in the future if this other person was miserable in the future. You know, that's what my mind had tried to convince me of. And so, you know, in some ways what I was seeing was that with that anger, the mind was willing to give up a sense of well-being here and now for some possibility of something in the future. And so that we see that, we see the as the mindfulness sees the way this state of mind, these reactive states, feel painful here and now, it's like the mindfulness begins to orient us towards letting go of those. We don't actually have to do a lot in this process. It's kind of amazing. I mean, we might think, and often we do think, oh, I see anger. Oh, this isn't useful. I need to stop the anger. That actually, I mean, that can be helpful at times if that is coming from a perspective of compassion. It's like, oh yeah, this is not helpful. Let's try something else. And if it's coming from that perspective, that might be helpful. But if it's coming from the perspective of, wow, I'm so angry and this is bad, I need to get rid of this anger, that's just aversion to anger. It's like we're using the same pattern of anger against the anger. And so what we begin to recognize, actually what we see is that if we're just willing to open to, okay, yep, this is what's happening right now. Wow, this hurts. Okay, this hurts. And then maybe, okay, you know, this is what's going on. Let me just get on with my day. You know, not try to either act on it or repress it. This is really the middle way the Buddha talked about. Neither repressing nor expressing our reactive emotions. Just opening to feeling them. And as we do that, it's like each moment that that happens, each moment as we open to a reactive emotion in that way, it gives the mind a little bit more information that those states don't lead towards well-being. And fortunately, because our whole system is designed, I think, it seems to me, our whole system is designed in a way to move us towards well-being, to move us towards homeostasis, to move us towards ease. That's the way our system is designed. And yet, the information that we're typically using is very short-sighted. You know, we are using information. How do I get the next thing that I want? This is you know, the way that I'll have ease and peace is if I get the thing that I want, or if I get rid of the thing that I don't want. And so that's the way our mind is operating, like me, unaware of the loss of ease here and now with that orientation. And so the mindfulness begins to give the mind a deeper education in well-being. And with the way our organism wants to head towards well-being, very naturally, the mind begins to kind of find its way to letting go of those reactive states. And I've seen this in my own practice. It's kind of amazing how the just that simple practice of watching my anger, how over the course of several months, the mind began to have not quite so much of a grip around it, be much more able to navigate, not be so caught. And I mean, it was a real challenge for me with that anger originally. I was like non-functional at times. And the simple practice of turning towards the anger and noticing it made, you know, really weakened its power. So this power of mindfulness, the power of mindfulness to weaken these reactive states, when we simply turn and are willing to learn, what is this experience of this reactivity? And simultaneously, the power of mindfulness is when we turn to, you know, when we're feeling good, when we have ease, when we have peace, when we have happiness, when we're feeling generous, when we turn to those, in the moment we see, wow, yes, the heart feels open, the heart feels unconstricted. The heart can respond here rather than react. The mind understands in that moment, yes, this is the way to well-being. And it creates the conditions for the mind to orient in that direction. And so this very simple, ordinary quality of mindfulness, when used in this way, with our ordinary experience, begins to show the way to letting go of the ways in which we struggle, get caught, and suffer, and begins to show the way towards engaging in the world with generosity and kindness and compassion, and with ourselves with those qualities as well. Let's see. I think I'll stop here for a second. I have a whole extra more section I can talk about, but I just want to see if there's any comments or questions or thoughts about what I've said so far. Use the mic.
Yeah. Thanks. Is that good? Is it on?
Yep.
I've been working with exactly this thing. So the past few, I used to think I'm not an angry person because I don't get angry at people. And I've noticed that I really have it in for things.
Uh-huh.
And when I've been working, it's very ordinary like that, about 100 times a day. And you say not functional at times. I mean, it turns me into an instant idiot. Something happens like I can't find the end of the tape. You know, the tape sticks to the dispenser. Or I walk into a restaurant and they're out of what I ordered. I make a wrong turn, and I've been working on this. And I notice that every time I get pissed off, and I'm more interested in being pissed off than actually finding a solution.
Oh, interesting. That's
like,
a great thing to notice.
So I was wearing the tape dispenser yesterday. It's like, you know, okay, my back of my mind knows there's a solution, but I really want to take it out and, you know, drive over it with my car. And, yesterday, I finally noticed there's actually a little tab on the dispenser. Like, I went through it three times.
Uh-huh.
And I've been working with something like, I mean, for 20 years, I've been struggling with these kinds of things.
And so,
anyway,
How are you working with it?
Because it happens something like 100 times a day, really.
This is great, because it happens so much, you have many opportunities.
It's a great mindfulness bell. And I've actually made some progress with it. At first I thought, you know, you just get pissed off in there, you know, and you don't have any control over it. And I've noticed that it has softened quite a lot, and it's actually been life-transforming, probably because it just happens so often. And it really turns me into a dysfunctional being. I mean, I think I'm smart, and it's like, just, you know, add annoyance, and suddenly I won't find a solution that's there because I'm just annoyed.
And so you've explored just being with, opening to the feeling? Or
I did at first, but at first I opened to the feeling, but more recently I found that it has become less, that maybe my mind has noticed how dysfunctional it can be.
Yes.
and make me. And it can have subtle interactions. And I mean, you can be nice to people, but sometimes when you're in a restaurant and they're out of what you're ordering, you're trying to be nice, but you're slightly annoyed.
Yeah.
And it's not their fault.
That's right, yeah.
You know, instead of sort of ordering something else, maybe say something like, well, I noticed you're out of that, as if they could do anything about it, right? And so it does have more than interactions with things, I think, involved in it.
And so what you're seeing, I mean, that it has weakened is
yeah.
due to the you know, turning with mindfulness towards it. You know, it's like that gives the mind the recognition, oh, actually, this isn't so helpful.
Yeah.
So it begins to weaken it. And it is a slow process. You know, I want to emphasize that, because, you know, some part of our mind goes, you know, gosh, I've seen this 100 times, and I've seen it, and why not? You know, why do I have to keep learning the same thing over and over again? And partly it's because, you know, it's like the mind's got its grooves. It's got its ruts. It's got its patterns. And we've cultivated those patterns many, many, many times. Like, how many times have you practiced that pattern of getting... Yeah, so, yeah, many, many, many.
Uncountable.
And so, you know, that when we start to see with mindfulness, oh, this isn't helpful, we somehow think we should be able to flip a switch and say, oh, don't do that anymore. But actually, this points to another lesson that's a deeper lesson, and that is, you know, that these patterns, these grooves that are worn, they've been worn because of repetition. You know, they've been worn because of choice that we've made and because of repetition. And, you know, it's not so much, at this point you begin to see, wow, you know, this isn't helpful, but I don't seem to be able to stop it.
And I do remember that point, actually.
Yeah.
It was a turning point.
And so that moment when we see, oh, this pattern, it's like the pattern has been launched back there. You know, somebody flipped the switch back there. It's been launched. And now I just get to watch it. I can't flip the switch to turn it off. What this begins to point to is just that there's a set of processes going on. And, you know, there's a little bit in this moment. There's a little bit of choice that we have about how do we respond to it. Do we react to it? Do we increase the frustration? Or do we watch it? And that begins to turn us, if we decide to watch, it begins to turn the pattern. But we also see that it's not that we can just say, yes, I'll stop doing this. It's not in our control in that way. What's in control in this moment is how we choose to respond. We have a little bit of choice there. Can I leap? Do I leap on it and just keep getting more frustrated? Or do I try to recognize, oh yeah, this is my opportunity to see this one again, you know, and to begin to recognize, ooh, that hurts, ooh, that's... And the learning happens. The learning happens slowly. And so it's a slow unwinding of these patterns. So thank you for the example.
So my ordinary anger gets triggers something from way back in my life, and so whatever it is that's going on today is probably not terribly important in one sense. It triggers an experience of being dismissed or ignored, and therefore not worthy.
Yes.
And then I think as a kid I learned too that, well, I got a lot of messages about how bad my anger was, because I used to fly into temper tantrums, as they were called then. And now I sort of have a subtler version of temper tantrums, and I'm sometimes, occasionally, if I become aware of what's going on, I will do some sort of silent self-affirmation. Doesn't always help, because I came to rely on the anger very strongly, and I find it very hard to let go of it, because it felt like a substitute for the affirmation I was really looking for.
Yeah, no, this is an important exploration. You know, I think often anger in our you know, growing up, and, you know, sometimes in our lives now, you know, anger is serving in a way to help us feel like, no, I'm okay. You know, if we're being told you're no good, if we're being denied a sense of being mirrored in a healthy way, anger is a very natural response, and it helps the organism in some way keep from collapsing into nothing. You know, so there's that. It has a function in a way as we're growing up, and so as we grow up, you know, we begin to see that, you know, that pattern maybe not being so helpful in the new situations, and yet have, again, this is pointing to how out of control things are. It's been very well worn in a way, you know, that anger, it's, and what that, so that anger is there, and it's, you know, it's like this situation reminds you of that, so you go back to that state, and you're back in that place of feeling like you need to be somehow protecting this being, you know, that it feels protective, that anger sometimes has that protective quality. And the idea of saying this anger is bad is really running directly counter to that protecting quality, right? So to say to yourself, oh, this anger is not helpful, it's running counter to the experience of, no, this is actually helping me. It's helping me from collapse. And so the middle way here is not to tell yourself to get rid of the anger, but to recognize this is anger. This is what's happening right now. And to begin to feel into it from the inside. And we start to see, you know, when we do that, if we don't come at it from the perspective of, you know, I need to get rid of this anger, but rather, let's learn about this anger. You know, what's happening here? You know, okay, there's this part it's trying to protect. It's trying to keep me safe. That's not something that, you know, that wish for safety, that wish for well-being is a wholesome wish. You know, it is a wholesome wish. And so if we, and at this point in, you know, what you're describing, the anger and that wholesome wish are so tightly connected that trying to get rid of the anger is like trying to repress that wholesome wish.
Well, and being told it was bad.
And being told it was bad.
Meant
right.
That trying to be wholesome was bad.
Yes.
At once upon a time.
so that, you know, that the you know, I think that it's really brilliant what the Buddha pointed to. It's like, no, we don't try to get rid of things. We open to them. And so it takes courage, and it takes time. You know, it's like, and sometimes if you're in the midst of an interaction, it's hard to take the time to say, oh, stop, you know, I'm going to go back to feel into when I was like 5 years old, and yeah, okay. That, I mean, we can't do that a lot. But what we can do is do the best we can in the situation, and then perhaps later in the day, go back and bring that situation to mind and then feel into it. Feel into that feeling of what it's like to be that 5-year-old or that 3-year-old, and feel into that place with that anger there, and feel into the feeling of protection and safety, and see maybe if you can begin to tease those two apart. You know, that mindfulness will begin to tease apart the quality of the wish for our safety and the anger that's constricting. And so it really takes a courage to meet it and be willing to explore what's there, you know, to not have any agenda or any sense that anything is wrong or bad, but let's just see what's here. Let's just watch it. And what I've seen happen is so often, you know, whatever it is, whether it's depression or anger or fear, if I'm willing to open to that, meet it, be, you know, willing to sit in the middle of it, so often I find it's like there's a thread back to some wholesome wish in that pattern. Whether it's, you know, I wish that I'm safe, or I wish that I'm happy, or I wish that I have love in my life. You know, that when I'm willing to open to it, as opposed to say, you know, this pattern here, whatever it is, depression, it's bad, I need to get rid of it. Instead, if I'm willing to say, depression feels like this. What's inside depression? And not digging. I mean, it's kind of a delicate dance, you know? It's like, we might think then, oh, okay, good, there's depression, let me dive in, let me like pull it apart and find what's, let me find that beautiful thing in the middle of it. And that doesn't work either. So it's kind of, you know, this very gentle, well, what is this experience? What is this experience of depression? What is this experience of anger? And slowly over time, the pieces of it begin to reveal themselves. Both the constricted pieces, the pieces that feel tight and held and rigid, and the pieces that are, you know, wholesome and beautiful underneath. So it takes time and it takes courage. But the fact that you've seen that, it's connected to that pattern, really helpful.
Yes, and one more thing in relation to your talk. I have a hunch that my racism is another form of needing superiority in order to feel wholesome.
That's a really good thing to look at, yeah. Yeah, and I think that pattern that you describe is probably a pretty widespread pattern in the minds of white privilege, you know, that somehow needing to feel better or is connected to that sense of being okay. So, yeah. Yeah, and it's really helpful to see that. It's not actually, I mean, when we start to see these patterns, you know, we see that this extra, this constriction is the unnecessary part. The feeling okay happens much more naturally as the heart is not constricted. It's like we don't have to have better than, less than. It's just like this is this. Thank you. Yeah.
I can't tell you how affirming your talk was today. And I think what's happening to me is I believe everybody that has patterns, and the longer you live, the harder they are to get rid of. And noticing starts to take the power away.
Yes.
And that's like a miracle.
It is like a miracle. Yeah.
And I was here the last Tuesday or Monday, I think. And anyway, this woman said, instead of trying, you said it a minute ago, trying to get rid of something, open to it, because there's a payoff for being open to it. There's something better to learn.
Yes.
Really, it's a payoff. But just imagine, all you have to do is notice it. Here I am again, I'm doing the same thing I said I wasn't going to do, and I don't want to do, and it's not me, the real me. All of these things. And then it'll start to have, it loses its power.
It does begin to lose. It takes time. We have to keep at it.
Oh, and it's actually, not quick.
No, and actually this is the piece. I mean, and here we are in the new year. You know, it's like resolutions are often, you know, a part of the new year. And, you know, let me do this. But a resolution, you know, a resolution of let me look at this. Let me just be with my patterns. You know, it takes not just making that once and saying I'm going to do that, but every time it happens, and every time you notice, like, wow, it happened 10 times, you know, in the last hour, and I didn't notice, but here I am noticing, let me notice this one. It takes that recommitment to notice
absolutely.
It. So it's you know, that those resolves, so often they get lost because we think we just need to make the resolve once, but it's like every time, just, you know, come back and, oh, yeah, I missed it last 10 times, but here I am. I get this opportunity.
And it's really a delight to notice because I know it's a step towards freedom.
And that's a great thing when it gets to that point, when it gets to be a delight and it's not like, oh, here it is again, but it's like, oh, here's another chance. Here's another opportunity to look at this. You know, it's a different mindset. And that comes as we see the value of the mindfulness.
I think she said, lean into the loss.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah.
I love that, out of that whole talk, which is beautiful. Mm-hmm. I got that.
Let's see. Yeah, there's time for one more. Yeah, behind you.
Are we supposed to say our name?
No, it's okay.
Okay. Oh, okay. I'm thinking of something else. What's very nice about this teaching is it seems like it's a third way of dealing with anger that has literally not presented itself to as a possibility for...
In our culture, it's not presented. Yes, exactly.
Because we're always taught we either have to repress our anger and just not even be angry in our thoughts, or we have to gratify our thirst for vengeance, and it's just one or the other. And the idea that we could channel that out in some fashion and realize this legitimately without being vindictive is just something that for, you know, so many years of my life has not even occurred as a possibility.
Exactly. Exactly. And it takes a, you know, it's a simple thing when we see it, but it takes, I mean, so it's an ordinary thing when we see it. But it takes a brilliant mind. I think it really took the brilliancy of the Buddha to say, look, this is the way.
And I think a lot of us are more influenced by cultural memes, even ones that we don't agree with, that we mentally don't agree with, than we realize. I mean, they're still getting into us, even if we mentally think we don't go with this kind of vindictive mentality. If it's in the culture, it's times where it's seeped in.
Whatever is, you know, there's a saying of the Buddha, whatever we frequently ponder becomes the inclination of our minds. And we actually end up frequently pondering what's in our environment. You know, it's like even if it just comes in through the side, it kind of seeps in there. So we need to take care with that.
One has these rare moments of thinking in ways that you believe 99% of the time you believe you would never think that way.
Yeah. And it's really helpful to be completely honest with yourself that you are, that is happening in that moment,
right,
and not think it's not happening.
Okay.
And we need to stop.
I could go.
So thank you all.